You're listening to Thoughtcast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm in Concord, Massachusetts, at the home of the theoretical physicist and novelist Alan Lightman. Now, that's an unusual combination, physicist and novelist. Think of it as a kind of left-brain, right-brain mind meld with interesting and unpredictable consequences. Is it possible that these two lobes are in some way duking it out in the mind of Alan Lightman? Well, here's a clue. His latest book, due in stores this autumn, is about the supernatural, and it's called Ghost. Alan Lightman, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Nice to be here, Jenny.
Alan, you've said in the past that, quote, the sciences and the arts have a lot to say to each other. It's a two-way street. But most of us are either on one side of the street or the other, Alan. Do you think that you're able to see things differently?
Well, probably so. I believe that I can understand the way scientists view the world, and I know that I can understand the way that artists view the world. And occasionally it is helpful to be able to encompass both of those views at the same time. So I guess in that sense, I see the world differently. I'm not sure what differently means here, but I am able to understand both the logical way of thinking and the intuitive way of thinking. And sometimes I feel like I have to flip a switch in my own mind going from one to the other. The best example of that is when I'm writing fiction, I sometimes start a paragraph with a topic sentence, which is a great idea for nonfiction, but it's fatal in fiction. And I can feel the two sides of me at a standoff there. And of course, if I'm writing fiction, the artist side always wins out.
Do you ever find yourself wondering which side of you will come out? The logical or the intuitive?
You mean in a given situation?
Right.
Well, it's unpredictable sometimes. I have learned now through experience that in some kinds of relationships, let's say relationships with the people, that it's the artistic humanistic side of me that needs to be present. And in other relationships, it's the scientific side. I mean, if I'm talking to my stockbroker or a banker, then I want to be very logical. If I'm talking to a person that I love, I don't necessarily want to be logical. I want to just feel it and feel them.
So because you are able to do these two things very well, do you sometimes end up speaking emotionally to your stockbroker and logically to your two daughters?
Probably so. Not to my advantage.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm speaking with the author and physicist Alan Lightman. You're probably best known to the layman for your first novel, Einstein's Dreams. And in that book, you imagine what Einstein might have been dreaming about in the weeks leading up to his discovery of the special theory of relativity, which was the spring of 1905. And of course, he's dreaming about physics. So there you are, the arts and the science there together, dreaming,
right,
and physics. Do you see this book, which has been very successful as a bestseller in multiple languages, as a symbol, in a way, or a marriage of these two aspects of you, and a successful one?
Definitely, yes. I probably didn't fully appreciate it at the time that I was writing the book, but I have since come to realize that the book was a perfect reflection of my dual interests. And I think that in other ways that all of my books have been, maybe not as explicitly as in Einstein's Dreams.
You have a new book coming out. It's called Ghost. How do you see Ghost as a fusion of these two aspects of yourself? It deals with the supernatural, and that really means subject matter that cannot be explained by science. Mm-hmm. You are a scientist. You are an atheist. What drew you to the paranormal, Alan?
Well, for one thing, there's a lot of interest in the country about science versus religion and where the boundaries of the two are and can they live together peacefully or not. And I think that science and religion and the supernatural both all involve faith. They're faith in different things. And I'm interested in faith, and I'm interested in why we believe what we believe. And there are some scientists in the book Ghost who have their own approach. And I wanted to just look at the different ways that scientists and non-scientists approach the world. The supernatural, of course, is an extreme experience. And I think that it brings into sharp contrast the different ways that scientists and humanists, you might say, look at the world.
Well, let's take a look at Ghost and what you do to the main character, whose name is David. He's a passive fellow, but bright, and he loses his job and takes a temporary position in a mortuary. And while in the slumber room, I think he's basically just sitting there collecting his thoughts, so to speak, in the dim of the late afternoon. There's a dead body laid out in front of him in this slumber room, and out of it comes a vapor. And he sees this, and he feels that it looks at him, is there for about 5 seconds, and then leaves.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you've just described it in much more detail than he is able to until well on into the book.
Yes, at first it's just something. It's a feeling almost that something's happened.
Yes.
But I have to ask you the question, why did David think the vapor looked at him? Did the vapor... It never said that the vapor had a face.
No. Well, that's a good question, and I don't know why he felt that. He never described a body or a ghost, and I don't know whether he actually saw a pair of eyes looking at him or he just felt that there was an intelligence there that was directed towards him, in which case he might have said, it looked at me.
Now, you're the author. Tell me what it's like for the author to not really know what David saw.
You have to trust your character. You've created a character and you've given the character enough life so that you believe the character. In the book, there are people who believe David saw something metaphysical and there are people who don't believe. But I, as the writer, I actually never had to decide myself whether he actually saw something. I know that he believed that he saw something. And I think the metaphysical experience is a personal experience. I mean, I think that at the core of religious belief is not really received wisdom, but it's an actual personal experience that the believer has. It's not necessarily sitting in church or reading the Bible or going to Sunday school lessons. I think that people who consider themselves devout actually have felt something at a personal level. It's a very private experience. And that's something that I wanted to suggest in this book, how powerful that private experience is.
Alan, you mentioned that Ghost is really an exploration of this sighting by David, and that you, the author, are not even sure exactly what it was he saw.
Mm-hmm.
Is the process of writing the book not only a way for David to come to terms with what he saw, but for you to come to terms with the supernatural, with non-scientific phenomena?
Yes, I think so. In the course of writing the book, I learned more about why people believe what they do. And I found that both groups, both people who believe in the supernatural and people who don't believe in the supernatural under any circumstances, have a very visceral attachment to their belief and are unwilling to modify it no matter what the facts and the evidence are. It's a very deeply rooted feeling that we have that dictates whether we either believe or we don't believe.
So does that apply to you as a person, Alan? Are you...
I think it probably applies to me as well, yes.
Do you think there is anything out there, any kind of phenomena that cannot be explained by science?
I believe that every physical phenomena can be explained by science.
But that doesn't include everything, does it?
No, it doesn't include everything. They're very interesting questions that I think science will never touch, like why did the universe come into being, or does God exist, or why are a man and woman attracted to each other?
I think science has an answer for that one.
Science has can document all the physiological changes that occur, but I don't think that science has an explanation for why the attraction occurs in the first place.
What about propagation of the species? Instinct.
Oh, yes. I mean, on the average, you can say that men and women are attracted to each other. But what I'm talking about is why a particular man is attracted to a particular woman. I mean, I'm sure that you know plenty of men that you feel either attraction for or no attraction. And I think it would probably be hard for you to explain exactly why it happens or doesn't happen.
Well, you're talking to the wrong woman on that front. I know exactly, but I do accept your point. I accept your point. You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with the author and physicist, Alan Lightman. Alan, I've been thinking that in both Einstein's dreams and Ghost, you're really writing a quest. There's a search, and both of these journeys push against the boundaries of science. They're trying to answer difficult questions. But in Einstein's dreams, science wins out. At the end of the day, Einstein figures out this phenomenal theory that explains time of all enormous topics, whereas in Ghost, science doesn't win out. It really focuses on the limits of science. It comes off as seeing inadequate, incomplete.
Yes, and it is, I believe it is incomplete.
Does this shift reflect in any way a shift of yours? In 1993, you wrote Einstein's Dreams, and 14 years later, 2007, you wrote Ghost. That's a big gap of time.
Well, I think, I mean, certainly I have matured as a person and as a writer. However, I think that even in 1993, that I was not so naive as to think that science had the answers to all questions. I don't think there's anything in Einstein's Dreams that says that science has no boundaries. It's just that it represents a successful scientific achievement.
Speaking of which, I want to go a little farther into Einstein's dreams, which really is a reverie about time.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a reverie about human nature, too.
Yeah. Just to clarify for everyone, each chapter in Einstein's dreams is devoted to a different dream of Einstein's. And in each dream, time behaves differently. One time it could be circular, in another it could go on forever. In another one it stops abruptly, in another it goes backwards. My favorite is the one that takes place on May 3rd, 1905. And in this, time is out of sync. And as a result, an effect can come before a cause, that sort of thing. Would you read, please, from that chapter?
Yes. I just happen to have the book open to the spot right here. Some fairy came in and provided me.
Suggested that you take a look.
That's right. A young woman sits near a fountain in the Botanischer Garten. She comes here every Sunday to smell the white double violets, the musk rose, the matted pink gillyflowers. Suddenly her heart soars. She blushes. She paces anxiously. She becomes happy for no reason. Days later, she meets a young man and is smitten with love. Are the two events not connected? But by what bizarre connection? By what twist in time? By what reversed logic? In this a-causal world, scientists are helpless. Their predictions become post-dictions. Their equations become justifications. Their logic illogic. Scientists turn reckless and mutter like gamblers who cannot stop betting. Scientists are buffoons, not because they are rational, but because the cosmos is irrational. Or perhaps it is not because the cosmos is irrational, but because they are rational. Who can say which in an a-causal world? In this world, artists are joyous. Unpredictability is the life of their paintings, their music, their novels. They delight in events not forecasted, happenings without explanation, retrospective. Most people have learned how to live in the moment. The argument goes that if the past has uncertain effect on the present, there is no need to dwell on the past. And if the present has little effect on the future, present actions need not be weighed for their consequence. Rather, each act is an island to be judged on its own. Families comfort a dying uncle not because of a likely inheritance, but because he is loved at that moment. Employees are hired not because of their resumes, but because of their good sense in interviews. Clerks trampled by their bosses fight back at each insult with no fear for their future. It is a world of impulse. It is a world of sincerity. It is a world in which every word spoken speaks just to that moment. Every glance given has only one meaning. Every touch has no past or no future. Every kiss is a kiss of immediacy.
Do you remember what you were thinking or feeling when you wrote that section, that chapter?
Well, I was probably thinking how much I wish I could live in the moment, which is something I have trouble doing, but something I aspire to. And I envy people who can live in the moment.
That world is really a haven for artists, but a nightmare for scientists.
Yes.
So what does that say? If you would perhaps like to live in that kind of world, what does that say about your attachment to science?
Well, I'd like to have it both ways. I would like to be able to make the predictions that science does. I would like to be able to have a world that is logical, that is subject to law, but also a world in which at a given moment you can forget about everything except the fact that you and I are sitting here right now looking at each other and not worrying about anything else except this moment of eye contact.
So what else are you worrying about? It's difficult for you. Do you know why? Does it have anything to do with your training as a scientist?
The fact that I worry about things in the future?
That you are not able to live in the moment?
I'm not able to live in the moment. I don't know whether that's related to my training as a scientist. I think that's a deeper personality issue.
Perhaps it's an issue for the age, our issue.
I think that certainly an issue for the age is the way that we are obsessed with speed and efficiency. And that obsession doesn't leave us time to stop and reflect. I think that it's that we have given up a lot of our inner selves, our reflective sides, our meditative side. And it does bother me. I think it's a social problem.
Alan, this is a subject that obviously is important to you. You've written an essay about it, again, in A Sense of the Mysterious, your collection of essays. It's called Prisoner of the Wired World. And you really do describe this feeling of being trapped by our society. First sentence, not long ago, while sitting at my desk at home, I suddenly had the horrifying realization that I no longer waste time. And if I were to jump down a sentence or two, I've underlined, for any available quantity of time during the day, I find a project. Indeed, I feel compelled to find a project. And jumping farther down again, I have subdivided my waking day into smaller and smaller units of efficient, in quotes, time use, until there is no fat left on the bone, no breathing spaces remaining. But that doesn't sound like an artist to me. You're also an artist.
No, that doesn't sound like an artist. That sounds like someone who's hell-bent on efficient use of their time. But it's not necessarily a scientist either.
If Einstein were dreaming, that sounds rather languorous and somehow inefficient.
Yes. Right. But I think that when in the creative moment, and the creative moment is very similar whether you're an artist or a scientist, I think that you do lose track of time. You lose track of where you are and who you are. You lose track of your ego. And that is sort of the ultimate of living in the moment. And that is when I'm happiest.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with the author and physicist, Alan Lightman. Alan, in addition to doing research in physics, you've also taught at Harvard and MIT, but at the moment, you are teaching as an adjunct professor of humanities at MIT, and you're teaching not physics, but writing. What has that been like for you to teach MIT students writing?
It's a wonderful experience because I found that MIT students, of course, they're very bright, they're quick. You don't have to tell them things twice. And I have found that a lot of MIT students, of course, there are many exceptions, but a lot of them, they have been very successful at math and science when they were in high school. They're often not very social people. They're loners. I mean, this is certainly the way that I was, and I think that most budding scientists are. And they're often out of touch with their emotional selves. And, of course, when you write, you get in touch. You have to examine your emotional life. That's part of what writing is. You're confronting your feelings about things. And so it's been exciting to see these students who are not used to confronting their emotional lives or thinking about them to have to examine them when they write. So that has been fun.
Speaking of what you were like as a kid, you have written, again in the essay, A Sense of the Mysterious, that you were socially inept. And I'd like to quote a passage here. You wrote that, quote, mathematics contrasted sharply with the incongruities and inconsistencies in people. The world of people had no certainty or logic. People confused me. Why do you think that was the case for you?
Well, because I think that I was struggling with this rational versus intuitive dichotomy that we've been talking about. And probably at that age, I was more weighted towards my rational, logical side. And I really expected to be able to figure people out. And I found that I couldn't do it.
Using your scientific method?
Yes. And I couldn't make predictions about how people would act in situations. It often appeared that people did contradictory things. And of course, people do contradictory things. And I found this disturbing. And now I have just accepted it as part of the human condition, that people are self-contradictory often.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of science and math whizzes are not in touch with their emotions when they're younger. Why is there this connection between such kids and a social awkwardness, a discomfort with interaction?
Well, because I think that science and mathematics are subjects that don't relate to people. I mean, they're about inanimate objects, they're about abstract ideas. It's an interior world. It's a world without people, basically. I mean, solving some algebraic equations doesn't really require any understanding of people whatsoever. On the other hand, if you're a history major and you're trying to figure out what were the causes of the Civil War, people have everything to do with it. And so I think that the subject matter itself and the kind of mind that is attracted to that subject matter is not a mind that would necessarily have social skills and be comfortable with people. There's a purity to the world of science and the world of mathematics, a purity which comes partly from the logic of it, that one thing follows ruthlessly from the next. And that purity can be very comforting to a person who's trying to find out what the world means. And once you start dealing with people, you lose that purity because people are not pure, they're not equations, they're unpredictable. They're often chaotic, like waves breaking on the shore.
And yet you became someone who has been able to more or less unite these two very different characteristics.
Yes.
First, you were comfortable with the sciences, and it took you a while to be more comfortable with the more unpredictable
the
side
humanities,
of life.
Yes.
When you were able to, what happened then? What changed in you? How did your life become different?
I think I became wiser, more accepting, more understanding. I mean, I'll give you one example of that. When someone talks to me about a problem that they're having, a personal problem, an emotional problem, I think that 25 years ago, I would have tried to solve the problem. And I believe that now I understand that often there's no solution to the problem, but equally often, what is needed is just to listen.
I think you've been told that, haven't you? In your life. This sounds like something you have heard before.
I probably was told it, but I didn't believe it. And to believe it, I had to learn it for myself. And I think that I have learned it for myself.
It sounds like you have come to reconcile your need for certainty, for precision, with, for lack of a better term, your softer side. Do you feel
yes,
that?
Yes, I do feel that. And that's one of the ways that I have changed as a result of having lived both in the world of science and the world of the arts.
And the subject of your work and your life, do you think it is this bridging of this chasm? Is that what you feel you have been doing?
Well, I think I've been bridging it, but I don't think that I have necessarily in all cases tried to bring the sciences and the arts together, because I don't think they should be together. I believe that they represent different ways of looking at the world, and although there are a lot of similarities between the sciences and the arts, I don't think that they are identical pursuits. I don't think that we should try to force them together. And so when you talk about bridging the chasm, I feel like I have a life in both. I have learned to appreciate both questions with answers and questions without answers. I have friends who are scientists and friends who are artists. I can find commonalities, but I also can see the differences, and I am not trying to negate the differences or eliminate the differences.
Last question, Alan Lightman. What will you be working on next?
I am working on a book-length poem that has been inspired by a great poem of the Indian poet Tagore. And the poem that I am writing is called Song to Two Worlds. And the first part is a ode to questions that have answers. And the second part is an ode to questions that don't have answers.
That sounds like a synthesis to me. Well, thank you very much, Alan Lightman, for the interview.
Thank you, Jenny.
You've been listening to the author, physicist, and educator, Alan Lightman. His previous works include Einstein's Dreams, Dance for Two, Diagnosis, Reunion, and A Sense of the Mysterious. His most recent book, called Ghost, will be published this fall. I'm Jenny Atiyah. Thanks for joining us.